The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with SuperValue Travel Insurance. Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance online at supervalue.ie.
And still with us, archivist Katrina Crowe and author Henrietta McCurvey. And we're also rejoined now by Fergus Sweeney. Fergus, you were talking earlier about what was going on in the world back in 1915, but you've also been taking a look at the Irish newspapers at the time.
Yeah, I took a trip down to the National Library during the week, John. It's a kind of a cumbersome process to try and look at the newspapers from the time. You have to get them on microfilm. You have to order some of them first and then get them on microfilm. And you can remember maybe from your students' days trying to copy things from microfilm, and gosh, it took a whole day just to get a few articles. But I have a few stories. The newspapers in those days were very much different from what they are today. For a start, I noticed that there weren't many pictures there at all, and I presume that was due to the cumbersome process of reproducing pictures in newspapers. I don't know whether anyone knows that.
I assume so. I mean, on the other hand, there's a fantastic collection of photographs held by the Cork Examiner and the Independent. The Independent stuff is now in the National Library.
Yeah.
So why do they have photographs that they weren't reproducing them? I can't answer the question.
Yeah.
Maybe someone else might read in and tell us.
Very few pictures in the papers that I... And the three papers that I went for were the Irish Times, the Cork Examiner and the Irish Independent. A lot of ads on the... And very few stories. A lot of ads in the front pages. Interesting, because you were speaking to Mark about sport earlier, and in the Irish Times, the sports pages are called Sport and Play. Sport and Play. So it's very quaint, isn't it?
I
took a look. There was an Olympics in 1912. The 1916 Olympics in Berlin were cancelled because of the First World War. In 1912, some of the sports and play in the Olympics were tug of war.
Yeah.
And then there was also a medal given out for art and literature. So, I mean, little wonder they were called
sport and play
at the time. But some of the ads here from the Cork Examiner, and this is from the front page. Dentistry, it says, painless extractions daily. 2 shillings. Sets from 2 guineas. Satisfaction guaranteed. The Examiner also has an ad, save coal by using carbonoid. It says it makes claim that it saves 50% in fuel, 1 shilling and 3 shilling tins. Anyone ever heard of carbonoid? No idea what it is.
Blank faces all round.
Yeah,
yes.
The Examiner, the Cork Examiner, I must give it its correct name because it only changed its name quite recently, didn't it? It says, wanted feather beds and all kinds of feathers bought. Highest prices paid. We pay carriage, send postal samples. Nolan and Sons feather merchants. And that wasn't the only ad. There was a lot of ads for wanting feathers. So presumably it was big business.
Well, eiderdowns and pillows would have been filled with feathers. It's much later that you get foam, which of course is a much inferior thing. A feather pillow is a lovely thing. And the feather bed refers to feather-filled mattresses.
Quills, so, I can imagine as well. Pens were made out of feathers. And were they used in hats as well?
They were used in hats too. You put a feather in your cap or nice decorative feathers on a lady's
hat. One thing
by a milliner.
I came across the feathers reminds me when I was doing my shipping forecast travels was that when... the Skelligs was originally leased in the 19th century to build a lighthouse. Mm-hmm. It was quite expensive because it had such a big puffin population.
Yes.
And the feathers were so valuable. So the lease was expensive because they knew they could make money from the feathers, from selling them.
The
it was big business.
And a lot of money lending ads in those days as well for all sorts of clients could get money. I presume there were a lot of pawn shops around as well.
There were, with three balls hanging outside them. I don't think, is there one even left in Dublin now? Probably not.
I remember going
to
one.
Cable Street.
Yes, on Cable Street.
Raritans, I remember it.
Yeah. Yes, if you're a pawn shop owner and you're still in business, get in touch with 51551 or email john@rte.ie.
Bicycles also were very popular at the time. I presume they were the main form of transport at the time. And here's one of the ads for bicycles on the front page of the Irish Independent. Very interesting. Irishmen take care, it says. Irishmen take care. Many a man has missed success because of indifferent health due to want of exercise. All the leading doctors now recommend cycling as a safe method for keeping fit. And then it lists various makes like Triumph. We've heard of Rover. I didn't know that they made bicycles. For 6/6 per month.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
The HP, 6/6.
Six and six.
Yeah.
You're so young, you don't remember pounds, shillings and pence.
So what, it just says 6/6, so is that £6 and 6 shillings?
No, six shillings and six pence.
Oh, right, okay.
So that'd be on the HP.
Per month.
But let's remember that the pneumatic tyre for bicycles was invented here in Dublin by John Boyd Dunlop.
Let's not forget that, by John Boyd Dunlop.
John Boyd Dunlop.
Was he Irish?
There's a thing I know that I shouldn't know, okay. And I do know. He was Irish, lived in Dublin, yeah.
Cars were becoming popular at the time. Now I want to skip to the Irish Times. Where was there? Oh, yeah, a couple of interesting car ads here. And again, it's on the front page. And as you see there, there's not a photograph in sight on the front page of the Irish Times.
Is there a news story inside?
No, I don't know. There's legal notices. There's situations vacant. Holiday resorts, advertisements for holiday resorts, but the car ads here, miscellaneous as well.
It's actually like the back page of the Irish Times now. Yes. In other words, they reversed
with the personal ads.
A lot fitted in there. There's great reading in it. Now, I found it great reading just from the point of view. It just gives a slice of life from the time. But look at some of the ads here for cars. The coupe, it says, for a doctor or a lady's use. The coupe for a doctor or a lady's use, 10 horsepower, Marlborough chassis, London built body, electric lighting, it's very small print here, electric lighting, Sankey steel detachable wheels, painted blue and upholstered in Bedford cord, whatever that is. The prettiest vehicle in town, it says. Price €250. No, that's not euro, that's pounds.
Yes, they hadn't brought in the euro back then.
No. And then 1950, there's another ad here, 1915 Overlands, special consignment, just received direct from New York, of 8 Model 81 touring cars. Immediate delivery from stock, Crawford's, 28 to 30 Dawson Street.
There you are.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it was actually cheaper, they worked out, to run a car rather than a horse and carriage. And you could travel much further in a car because it went faster than a horse and carriage. The guy who ran the local government board estimated that if the chief secretary wanted to find out what was happening down in Dingle, for example, and not, quote, take for granted the unreliable reports of the local constabulary, if he wanted to see in person, he could do in 24 hours what it would take 5 days to do on a horse and carriage. So buy a car. They are very rare on the streets still in 1915, but they're starting to be very popular.
I see. And Fergus, you mentioned there situations vacant. I know you're now rifling your way through another newspaper of the day, but you did mention situations vacant. I will get to that in a moment.
Okay, we'll get to them. Just when you mentioned there constabulary, there was an interesting, what paper is this? The Cork Examiner. On the bottom of page, I've lost the page, but anyway, it's one of the inside pages, and it says, found, stray calf awaits a claimant at Charleville. Apply to constabulary. So that was 1915.
A calf in the barracks.
I
often think of the Hemingway short story, you know, the for sale baby shoes never worn, which he always said was his best ever thing that he wrote, when I read the small ads in old newspapers, because they're these complete little worlds appearing on the page.
Oh, yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Before we get on to the situations vacants, only because I haven't found them yet, I've got so much in front of me, but here's a very interesting ad, and again, it's in, what paper is this? This is the Irish Times. It's page 2 of the Irish Times, and it's under the headline, The Art of Sweet Persuasion. Now, I wasn't too sure if it was an ad or where there was a news story, but actually, I think it is an ad, and it's an ad for White's Wafer Oatmeal, and it's in the form of a letter. So obviously they had received this letter into the company and decided, we'll just print this, and this is the ad. And it says, dear sirs, enclosed please find 72 fronts from White's Wafer Oatmeal, for which will you kindly send, at your earliest convenience, 2 dessert spoons. same as before. So this person, and it's signed a Mrs. B. Hand. So she's obviously got the dessert spoons before. And I remember in the 1970s, Club Milk, I used to save the wrappers and sent off for a dinky set and a racetrack. So Mrs. B. Hand was doing this in 1915 with the Whites. But the letter goes on. I've been using your oatmeal now for 10 years, making porridge every morning, summer and winter for my children. And they enjoy it more than all the bacon and eggs in the land.
The rasher's demise.
I need not tell you that I recommend it whenever I can, for although it has gone up 1 penny in price lately, it contains better food value than anything at the same price. Thanking you in anticipation, yours faithfully, signed, Mrs. B. Hand. Isn't that great?
That's amazing.
Isn't it fantastic? Now, what did you want me to
say? Situation's vacant. I'm just fascinated by you.
Hold on now. You're going to have to chat among yourselves there when I find them.
I can tell you 2 things which I just remember from the Irish Times. The Irish Times is a Protestant newspaper. So they have many, many ads for Protestant lady typists. And they could do that. They were able to discriminate in terms of religion at the time. You had to be a proven Protestant lady typist with certain skills to get the job. And there's another lovely one where it says, boy messenger want granted. And then in capital letters, must be able to ride a bike. They obviously had applicants before who pretended they could ride a bike and then didn't. Yes. So those are two examples from the time.
The modern day equivalent would be looking for a clean driving license. Yes,
exactly.
for a sales job. Yeah. By the way, there's some people clarifying where John Boyd Dunlop was born. Kevin in Kildare says he was born in Scotland, he died in Dublin, but that is disputed by another texter who says John Boyd Dunlop was from Belfast.
Well, he lived in Dublin. I didn't go so far as to say he was born here.
But
he certainly lived in Dublin, I think, at the time that he invented the tires.
So. Right, okay, that clarifies that. Yeah. And on drinking pints as well, Katrina says, my boyfriend, now my husband, ordered a pint for me in Searson's in Baggot Street in 1977 and was refused. Okay. They were not serving women pints even at that stage. I wonder if there's a pub anywhere in Ireland that doesn't.
I can't think of it. But it might come back in as a fashion. You never know.
I think the law didn't change until 2002. Yeah. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who can confirm slash correct me on that one. But much later than you would have thought. I think a lot of the pubs had given in by that stage. But legally, the position didn't change for a long time.
And Adrian says, my father used to deal in feathers. He collected and exported them to Germany. And Jer in Cork says, always love to listen to Katrina. Erudition with humour. There you are, Katrina.
Yes. Thank you very much.
High praise for you ahead of your busy day. Now, have you uncovered vacant, Fergus?
Irish Times, and again, it's on page one. It was actually, okay, there's a headline here, Employment Wanted, but there's another headline, Male Servants Disengaged. And this is where if you were unemployed or out of work, looking for a job. I don't suppose there was unemployment statistics at the time. I can't imagine. I don't know. But anyway, if you were looking for a job.
We don't have labour exchanges till in 1911, the Lloyd George brings in the Unemployment
Benefit
Insurance Act.
Okay.
Which means that there should have been some way of measuring it in terms of the people who were claiming unemployment assistance when they were out of work. That's just a technical point.
But so the two headlines here, male servants wanted and male servants disengaged. So I'm wondering, is it only if you were unemployed, is there only males that could advertise? Now, a lot of them do here say for they give their religion, it's always RC or Protestant in the ad, and then it's a married couple and she's able to do work around the farm or whatever as well. So maybe it was the males that had to take out the advert. But I'll read one or two of them. This first one says, rabbit trapping wanted. Experts with tackle will pay cash down and exterminate. Address Dunbar. It's something about Fraser, there's a word I can't read there, 15 Fleet Street, Dublin. So this is a guy, obviously, who's skilled in catching rabbits, and he wants to... But it says, pay cash? Will pay cash down. So he's offering to pay in order to catch
some... That doesn't make a whole lot of sense,
no.
But I'm sure...
Unless the rabbits are very valuable. I presume they were eaten at the time.
Rabbits were eaten at the time. They were for sale in the shops, and of course their pelts were valuable for making the cheaper kind of fur coat, which were very popular at the time too. But they were also liable to eat your crops. And agricultural Dublin was very agricultural back then. The city was quite small compared to what it is now. So you had a huge agricultural hinterland, and it would be worth the while of a farmer getting someone in to get rid of the rabbits if they were starting to proliferate too much. And as we know, the term breeds like rabbits is not there for nothing.
No.
They really increase in huge proportion.
Dick Warner actually is writing in the Examiner today about invasive species and animals, and he mentions the rabbit and how it was brought here in the 12th century by the Normans, but to the delight of the foxes. The foxes were delighted. The point he's making is that, you know, we give out about invasive species and everything, but over time they become part of the landscape, so we should love them a little bit more. Stewards and gardeners disengaged. A lady wishes to recommend her gardener. Good all-round man, strong, hardworking, RC, married, so family, south of Ireland preferred. Apply Mrs. Alfred Delap, Coolnagoor, Dungarvan, County Waterford. Isn't that interesting? That must have been quite prestigious for that gardener to get an ad taken out by like that. Yeah, and there's the ad right below it. Well, this guy obviously isn't such a good gardener because it just says good plain working gardener, married, etc., three children. So he's only plain. The guy above him has got a lot of recommendations. Here's an interesting notice as well in the Irish Times, and it's taken out by the Royal Zoological Society of Ireland. The council met on Saturday. This is Monday's papers now, remember. The council met on Saturday and there's a list of people who are at the council, and then goes on to say, the secretary announced an acceptable present of hay and straw from Miss Busted. Large quantities of these commodities are used for the animals in the gardens. A horse was received from the commandant of the RIC depot, Phoenix Park. A golden pheasant was also sent by anonymous donor. And it goes on to list the number of visitors that were in the zoo that week, 19,052. And then it goes on to recommend, there was a big gathering of volunteers in Dublin on the Saturday, which is one of the few news stories, apart from ongoings in the First World War, one of the few news stories that's covered. But this goes on to say that all the volunteers, and they do parade in the Phoenix Park, they say they should come along to the zoo to have a look at the large stock of carnivora. And it should attract the country visitors, and the unique collection of anthropoids in the monkey house. Just in case the volunteers didn't have much to do.
Well, there were 27,000 volunteers, and the city was out in force on Easter Sunday 99 years ago to observe, 100 years ago, to see these people marching from the Phoenix Park where they drilled to the Parnell Monument, which had newly been installed in 1911, and there John Redmond addressed them. And it was a serious moment in terms of the Irish Parliamentary Party's adherence to World War One, the encouragement of people to enlist further. Enlistment is starting to drop at this point because the news is coming back from the front. Telegrams are arriving announcing deaths. People are coming back with horrific experiences to recount. They have yet to undergo the horrors of Gallipoli later in 1915, but it's starting to drop. So this was a big moment in terms of Redmond encouraging his volunteers to enlist in the war.
And presumably the volunteers came from all over the country.
They did. Yeah, so there would have been a lot of business for the
trains.
In
fact, I can tell you, yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's the Irish Independent, it's headlined on page 5, and the Irish Independent takes numerous columns to tell the story about how 40 trains, and they describe it as one of the biggest transport of individuals from every town and city in the country to Dublin. But there's an interesting difference between the Irish Independent's coverage of that event and the Irish Times. The Irish Times, you said there was 27,000, Katrina. The Irish Independent puts it at between 25,000 and 30,000. The Irish Times plays it down altogether, and there's 20,000 national volunteers assembled in Dublin yesterday from all parts of Ireland. They were a stalwart and well-behaved body of Irishmen, but they were not soldiers. Only the Belfast divisions and a few others were properly armed and equipped and fairly well drilled. Punctuality and precision were entirely wanting from the parade in the Phoenix Park, and the march past Mr. Redmond was merely a procession. In a word, the value of the national volunteers for any military purpose, home or foreign, is at present negligible. And then it goes on to read, we are not sneering at them. And then goes on to tell the story.
Not.
But yeah,
I mean, the Irish Times is a unionist newspaper.
Yeah.
And it wanted everyone to join the army, and none of this nonsense about being the volunteers. Just sign up, lads. Whereas the Independent was owned by William Martin Murphy, who would have been a supporter of the Irish Parliamentary Party.
Against whom the lockout was taken.
Against whom the lockout. And also the owner, he also owned the Dublin Tramway Company. So that tram that people are going to see today and play around with would have been originally owned by William Martin Murphy.
But you know the way the newspapers...
He was the Dennis O'Brien of his day.
Yeah. Do you know the way the newspapers in those days did headline after headline after headline and then on into the story? So here was the headline. The first headline is Great Display in Dublin. This is page 5 now at the Irish Independent. So you've had to go through 5 pages of ads virtually first. I think the Great War may have been featured in one of the page 4 or something. So the first headline is Great Display in Dublin. Then Ireland's Armed Sons. Then Mass Display of Volunteers. Now we're on to the third headline. The fourth headline, A Historic Review. Headline number 5, over 40 special trains bring thousands to Dublin. Then unprecedented scene. Next headline, imposing spectacle in the Phoenix Park and mighty multitude. And there are two more headlines to go before you get into the story.
Fascinating.
Isn't it just? Yeah.
What's this headline in the Cork Examiner? Ingenious devices to save lives of pirates victims.
Okay, yeah.
What's that about?
Well, there was a disaster that year Yes, I have it here. The Falaba disaster, had we heard about that? Right, okay, let me just read it. Again, it's in the Cork Examiner, page 2, air life belts, and it says, ingenious devices to save lives of pirates' victims. That's actually the headline. One of the ingenious devices which has come to the front as a result of the war is the life-saving waistcoat, and it is anticipated that the Falaba disaster will considerably increase the demand. This was a UK steamer that was sunk by the Germans. I think it was only weeks before, and 104 people were killed. So they are now saying that there's a guy in London that's selling these new inventions, which are life belts, and that they're particularly popular with naval men and other people that work on the sea. It goes on to say, the ideal waistcoat is one which can be worn all the time, unnoticed, and yet be sufficiently buoyant to keep a man afloat for hours. So
a life jacket.
The life jacket, yeah. must just have been invented.
And of course, the really big disaster, which occurs a little after this, is the sinking of the Lusitania, which happens in April 1915, a few days after that massive volunteer meeting in the Phoenix Park. And that, of course, becomes another lever for recruitment. There are posters all over the town saying, avenge the Lusitania, join up and fight back. How many? 1,198 people killed just off the old head of Kinsale.
Sank in 18 minutes, I believe, wasn't it?
Really,
it must have been
fast.
Incredible to watch it.
Sunk by that evil thing, a U-boat, which is quite a new thing in World War One. So, yeah, there was plenty of disaster going on at the time.
And plenty of texts directed at you, Henrietta. Women minding their own children and working in the home did valuable work. In old photos, I see nothing but genuinely smiling, laughing children, even though they are cash poor. We're cash poor. Some kids now don't see their mums from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m.
I completely understand what they mean. And I think the point that I was making in the book is that it's okay to do one or the other.
Yes,
that people should have the right to choose.
Yeah, Sheila and Carla says, I've just started Henrietta's book, What Becomes of Us Over the Weekend, and it's a fascinating insight to women's roles and reminds her of stories my granny and mother told me. So there you are. Martina in Fairbury says that book about 1916 to 66 sounds great. We need another wave of feminism now. And actually one man you might target in a new feminist wave is Norman in Bray, who says, there is nothing attractive whatsoever in women drinking pints. Marilyn Monroe or Audrey Hepburn wouldn't have been seen dead drinking a pint. Is there anything more elegant than a woman in evening gloves sipping a cocktail? So a cocktail it is, folks. And Miriam says, I will never forget the raised eyebrows in the Silken Thomas in Kildare Town when I ordered a pint back in 1979. I was a blow-in. Ever after that, I stuck to the unofficial rules. That's Miriam breaking the mold, let's say, back in 1979. Anyway, Fergus, anything else?
Yeah, other things. Cycling accident. Obviously, bikes, as we said, were unpopular at the time. So here's a little notice in the Cork Examiner. Cycling accident. On Saturday night, a soldier, Private John O'Hagan, was knocked down by a cyclist on George's Quay and received injuries to his ribs. The ambulance was requisitioned, and the injured man was taken to the South Infirmary, where he was detained for the night. There's a story about a Cork tramway fatality above it, and below it it says, sailor's shocking death. This is the Cork Examiner. And this is a story from London, actually. A verdict of accidental death was returned at Birmingham on Saturday at the inquest on David Bradbury, stoker in the Navy, who, while on the way to join his ship after 4 days leave, was killed on the railway. Deceased struck up acquaintance with a soldier, and the pair took into the compartment with them 2 bottles of whiskey. At Castle Bromwich, the communication cord was pulled and the guard found Bradbury trying to alight. He was persuaded to sit down, but when the train restarted, he fell out and was killed. So that was quite tragic. There was another train fatality mentioned somewhere else, and it referred to the fact that one of the company's servants found the deceased. So one of the company's servants. The language in those days is quite interesting as well. Yeah.
Well, that would civil often servant have meant employee,
employee, wouldn't it? Yeah. That would have often been used in...
As employee.
Used employee. As employee.
I mean, the term civil servant is still in use. Nobody ever thinks about it, but it's a relic of those days.
Yeah.
But they sound like you know, blueprints for stories out of Dubliners. James Joyce's Dubliners. Yeah. He deals with trains quite a bit.
Does he?
And there is one dreadful story about a woman who threw herself under a train at Sydney Parade, a painful case. So they're a new thing, and they're dangerous. People have to learn to
drink was dangerous then as well.
Well, and trains are dangerous.
No, but I'm talking about drink. I've moved on now. I was trying to get a little segue from one to the other. Drink and the
drink.
War
yes.
is a headline in the Cork Examiner. The abolition question, Archbishop of Canterbury's views. And the Archbishop has written a letter to the paper saying that in order to support the soldiers, people back home should give up drink altogether, merely to support them. Now, I don't know why, but presumably it's because they don't have access to drink when they're on the front, and rather than them then stressing and being jealous over their families back home still drinking, he wanted them to give up. And the writer here says that the king at the time, the king has announced his own readiness to set the example and give up drink.
I'd say the response was overwhelmingly no, we're not giving up drink to support the soldiers at the front. It doesn't make any sense. And people like drinking.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever asked us to do that since, have they? Didn't happen in World War II.
To give up drink?
Yeah,
I think last Thursday I was told to give it up on Friday.
You can have it, you just can't have it.
I did have it, believe me.
Yes, that's true. I believe there were a lot of hen and stag parties arranged for Good Friday night. They didn't realise that these would be English and Scottish visitors mainly. Yeah. John in Dublin wants to know, is it true the pubs around O'Connell Street are only charging 1916 prices today? Two chances, John. And Rhoda in Donnybrook says, please tell Henrietta, I joined RTE as a production assistant in 1963. It was anything but boring. It was a blast. There were quite a few women producers. I worked for two of them in my first year. The 14 PAs often doubled as researchers. The hours were long. We worked hard, but never a dull moment. If you had to edit a videotape, it added £100 to your budget as the tapes were physically spliced in those days. So an insight into what happened here.
It's a name you don't hear much anymore, Rhoda.
Yes, indeed.
Rhoda, do you remember Rhoda from, was there a television programme or was she from the Mary Tyler Moore show?
I'm not sure.
I think she became a spin-off of the Mary Tyler Moore, didn't she? And got her own show as Rhoda.
That's Rhoda. A bit of TV history thrown in as well, and Fergus, what else?
A notice from Social and Personal. Mr John Lavery has been laid up for some time with a very severe attack of influenza. He is better now, and so he and Mrs Lavery have left London for Brighton for a few days.
Well, we're delighted to know about their illnesses and their movements. You know, that's one of those things about rich people, that they think everyone is interested in what's going on.
So I wonder...
But they were the celebrities of the day. Yeah. I wonder, is that Lavery, the painter?
Oh, I would imagine it was.
Well, I don't know.
Mr. John Lavery.
Yeah.
And
he becomes Sir John Lavery at a certain point, but I'm not sure when.
And does he have... Or his wife, is his wife involved with the very famous Irishman at some stage?
Hazel.
Yeah involved with
Michael Collins.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But no, presumably he wouldn't have put that notice in. It is Social and Personal. It's just the gossip column.
It may be that someone picked it up and did it, The celebrities of the day.
It's the Twitter of its time.
Yes, indeed. Thanks a million, Fergus, for going rifling through all the newspapers from 1915. Thanks also to Katrina Crowe and to Henrietta McCurb. Now, you're very welcome back. And just to say that we've been joined by a gang of Hawaiian shirt-wearing ukulele players. And the ukulele became popular for the first time after an appearance in the Hawaiian Pavilion at the Panama Pacific International Exposition in San Francisco. That happened in 1915. So how could we resist having a ukulele band in this morning? I'm joined by 1, 2, 3, 7 players standing in front of me, and we're going to hear from them in a second. And I'm actually dreading it because, you'll find out in a moment why. Eileen Hassett, good morning.
Good morning, John. How are you?
And you're the person who is organising two special ukulele workshops, and apparently ukulele playing is very much on the up in Dublin at the moment.
Very much, very much. There's actually four ukulele groups that meet weekly in the Dublin area. There's Rugs, which is Brath Farnham Ukulele Group. There's Dunleary in the Ablana Centre on a Saturday morning. There's a Tuesday ukulele in the Stag's Head, and there's one down in Greystones as well.
I see. And there are probably a few around the country, are there?
There is. Actually, there's 30 ukulele players in Tralee, I believe. They're going to start one in Dundalk shortly. They're everywhere. There's one in Belfast. There's a big gang in Cork. Yeah.
So what is it about ukulele playing?
It's easy. It's easy and it's fun.
Is it that easy?
It is.
Well, I've spent half my weekend trying to learn how to play, and it was anything. It was far from being fun and easy. But that's maybe only me and my fingers.
Oh, you're doing great. You're doing great. I heard you earlier. You're brilliant.
No, I don't know about that. Well, anyway, we're going to hear the band in a moment. But before we do, I actually went to one of the classes during the week, because I think the idea is that I'm going to be playing for a few seconds anyway, live on air this morning. Anyway, here's a taste of how I got on at that class during the week.
Hello everybody, my name is Sheila Fox. This is a beginner's class tonight, and we're going to teach you how to play the ukulele. We have three here. One is a soprano size, one is a tenor size, and one is a concert size. You can pick whatever size you like and we'll get cracking. Hi John, have you played ukulele before?
I haven't, ever.
And which of these do you think you'd like to try on?
I think the soprano ukulele, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Most beginners start in that size, but sometimes if your fingers are bigger, you might go for a bigger one, but it's good to start there anyway.
Well, what about my fingers then? Are they average size, big, small?
Yeah, I think just start at the soprano and see how you go from there.
Okay, that's all right. That's okay. Okay, there's a lot of confidence here in my ability to do this.
With the ukulele, you generally strum with your pointer finger, and kind of keep it floppy, like you're trying to splash some milk off it or something like that. This is your pointer finger there. So we're going to go strum down and damp. Down and cover with your hand. Down. Lime in the coconut and drank them both up. You put the lime in the coconut and drank them both up. Excellent, John. You're so good. How are you feeling about it so far, John?
I think I'm the best boy in the class. It's just, it's difficult to get the strumming right. Yeah. This class has more than one teacher. I'm now joined by Connor. Connor, good morning.
How are things, John? I'm Connor. I'm from Rathfarnham.
How do you become a ukulele teacher?
Fail at everything else in life.
When all else fails.
Yeah.
So I play the ukulele.
I played guitar for a while, and then I picked this up about 4 years ago, and it just, I don't know, just kind of expanded, and a lot of people were interested in it. So,
Sheila, you're setting me a task for Monday morning. What is it?
I am that you are going to play with our group on Monday morning. You're going to be proficient in a song, and it's going to sound amazing. I'm a bit shaky here, but I'll trust you. I'll trust you that you'll practice all over the weekend.
I will, of course. you're giving this to me to take away.
Okay, so we're going to singing in the rain. So this is a two chord song.
Okay.
Lovely.
Blown my mind.
Okay. Here we go. I'm singing
in the rain. Which one of you isn't playing it properly?
Well, you see, it's very hard when you just start playing the ukulele. It takes a long time to sing and play together.
And another man in the classroom here is Kieran. Is it Kieran?
It is, John. How are you?
And tell me about you and your ukulele.
Like yourself, I'm a kid dog, so we play it left-handed, so we reverse the strings. Been playing for about 2 years, a little over. If I don't play my ukulele every day, I feel my day is not fulfilled.
And what's your day job, Kieran?
My day job, I'm in the army. I'm a welfare officer in the military. But I've actually introduced, the ukulele into the military, and it's now, I know ukulele players that are serving in Syria with the UN there, and there are ukulele players in Lebanon happily playing away when they get a moment. Their colleagues are probably not too impressed having to listen to them, for 6 months, but the ones that brought the ukuleles overseas have really enjoyed it, and it gives them, something positive to do when they get that little downtime that they get. Because I'm quite passionate about it, because I think one of the things that I just mentioned, John, is that I am an addiction counsellor. And one of the things that I'm doing at the moment with a group of people in recovery, nothing to do with the military, by the way, is we've introduced ukulele for the people in recovery. And it's just been going from strength to strength.
So, Kieran, I have, 3 days to learn to play a tune and the ukulele, and I was looking forward to a nice peaceful Easter weekend. Any advice for me?
Yeah. Don't worry about how you hold it. Don't worry about whether you use your finger or your thumb. Just enjoy it, John. It'll just come to you. It's just really a fun instrument. It's called a happy instrument for a reason. People are happy playing.
Great stuff, Kieran. Ha 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 ha!
Yes, thanks for all the guidance, Kieran. Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And here I am trying to do an F, is it?
F.
Is that an F? A very scratchy F. Eileen, why are you looking at me as if, I'd never
seen...
Would you say this is an F?
Yeah.
Okay, close listen, I'll give you 5 seconds of it and then we can go into Singing in the Rain. What about that?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like anything approaching music, but anyway. Okay. Okay, we'll give it a start. Okay, join in now, please. Please, save me here. I spent hours at the weekend going nowhere. That's lovely. Brilliant. And personally, I think I was the standout performer in that. Thank you for drowning it all out with your singing and your ukulele playing. Eileen, two special ukulele workshops are being organised. Tell us about them, where and when.
Yeah, they're on next Saturday and next Sunday in the Dublin United Arts Centre, Fitzwilliam Street. And Finlay Allison, who is Scotland's favourite ukulele tutor, is coming over. He's doing an absolute beginner's class. We're even providing the ukulele so people can have played at all. Yeah, okay. On Sunday.
Yeah.
And on Saturday, it's kind of Improvers Plus, and it's kind of geared towards the people that are in these groups here that have one or two chords already.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So it's from 1 o'clock till 6 o'clock on Saturday and 1 till 5 on Sunday.
Great stuff. Well, I mean, is it easier than the guitar to learn? Is it?
Much. There's only 4 strings.
Yeah.
And like one finger and you're playing a chord.
One, so you have C7 now, I'm told.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
C7 sounds like C7 to me anyway. And we're going to have more from you. You're going to sing us out later in the show, or play us out later in the show. But thanks for now to Eileen and her troops. And what about this? Thanks. That's a bit of music from Charlie Chaplin's most famous film, The Tramp. It was actually released in 1915, and that's the same year that the Irish film industry was born. Yes, the very first Irish film was made in 1915. It was called Fun at Finglas Fair. It was never released because all prints were destroyed during the Rising in 1916. And to tell us more about that, filmmaker Brian Redden joins us on the line. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thank you, Brian. And tell us something about Fun at Finglas Fair.
So Fun at Finglas Fair was a film that was produced by an Irish-American guy by the name of James Sullivan. And he was a fascinating guy because, as you rightly point out, the Irish film industry was starting around that time, 1915. A lot had been happening in Ireland. Film was only in its infancy. It was the 1890s, 1895 or so when the first films came out. So we're only talking about, 20 years later, and it had arrived in Ireland. You had an industry down in Kerry with a company called the Calum Company who come over from America to use Beaufort around Kerry as a kind of a location for making films outside of the United States. And then in Dublin, the hub of it was a company called the Film Company of Ireland, the FCI, formed by James Sullivan. And originally, he formed the company to try, he was quite a nationalist, and he formed the company to make films really with a nationalist slant. They were kind of anti-English films. And within that, Fun of the Fingers Fair was one of those movies. It was made, it was basically about two English crooks who escape from jail, and they come over to Ireland, and they end up at the Fingers Fair, and they rob a group of farmers, and the farmers retaliate and end up throwing them in the canal. So it's a really simple, straightforward story. It was directed by, the reason it's considered one of the first Irish feature fiction films is because it was directed by an Irishman, produced by an Irishman, and starred Irish actors. So F.J. McCormack, who would be well known to people at the time as an Abbey stage actor, both directed and starred in it. But sadly, nobody ever saw it. So no one really knows who else was in it or what else. That's the basic story of the film. But it was destroyed along with, you see, the Film Company of Ireland had their offices in Dame Street. And a lot of the early movies which they made, and Fun of Fingers Fair was just one of them. Did one called Fun of the Puck Fair. People had a lot of fun at fairs in those days, obviously. They had Irish Jarvey Tales, and another one. Another one was called O'Neill of the Glen. And they all got destroyed in a fire in 1916. So we never got to see them, unfortunately.
And but the film itself was emerged from a film competition, Brian.
Yeah, there was a film competition that ran in 1915 where a proprietor of one of the cinemas in Dublin, I think, remember, there weren't that many cinemas in Dublin at the time. It had only been, I think it was 1909, if I'm correct, when James Joyce opened the Volta, and that failed. So there wasn't that many cinemas around Dublin at the time, but one was called the Masterpiece Picture House, which was on Talbot Street. And the proprietor of that picture house was a guy called Charles McAvoy. And he ran a competition in 1950. And he was very specific about the terms of the competition. The prize was 3 guineas. And it was to make an Irish comedy. And it was to run not more than 1,000 feet and to consist of not more than 25 scenes. So he was very specific about what he wanted to show in the cinema. And as part of that, out of that competition came Fun at the Fingers Fair.
And have we any idea what it was like?
By all accounts, and there are some contemporary accounts that said it was very good, and it could have been very, very good. There were a group of people who went to see it. It was screened once at a trade fair in April 1916. So it was screened for cinema proprietors and managers and things like that, presumably the cast and crew. And reports from the time say that it was very good, and it could have been a huge success. But sadly, we never got to see it. Now, there's conflicting reports as to actually what happened to it. The company who made it, as I say, was owned by this Irish guy. Actually, he was an Irish guy born in Kerry, but then emigrated to the States, James Sullivan. And his company, as I said, his offices were on Dame Street. So one report says that went up in flames during the Rising, and they lost all the films there. Another report says that actually during that screening in April 1916, the British soldiers came into the cinema, saw this film, which was essentially an anti-British film because it depicted British criminals and crooks getting their comeuppance by Irish people, and they basically pulled the film reel from the reel-to-reel and destroyed it there on the day. So either they came in and destroyed it as it was just after the screening, or it went up in flames. We don't really know what happened to it, but it definitely doesn't exist anymore.
I presume Finglas was full of fields at the time.
Fingers, yeah, there was the famous fair in Fingers, so presumably there's no stills from it, there's no grabs from it, there's no evidence of it at all, so we don't know what exactly was in it. We know the basic plot of it, but presumably there was a lot of grassland and fields in Fingers, and people had come up to trade cattle or whatnot, because the story does centre around farmers at the fair being duped by these English crooks. So I assume it was a lot of... See, back in those days when they made films, they weren't exactly full of plot, they weren't exactly terribly exciting. Like the very first films were just entitled that the Lumiere brothers made in France in 1895. I mean, the very first film ever was simply titled Workers Leaving a Factory, and that's what it was. And then you had Train Leaving a Station. In fact, the first films ever shot in Ireland, the silent films that were, you know, only like a few seconds long, the very first one was People on Saxville Street. So they weren't exactly thrilling, you know?
No, they don't sound it anyway. And Brian, everyone knows Barry Fitzgerald, the Hollywood actor and star of such movies as The Quiet Man and How Green Was My Valley. You have an interesting story about his brother, who was in the GPO in 1916.
Yeah, this is a fascinating little tidbit about 1916. So Arthur Shields was the brother of Barry Fitzgerald. As you rightly pointed out, he was the guy in The Quiet Man. And actually, Arthur Shields was also in The Quiet Man. He played the Protestant minister in the Quiet Man, the guy who discovers that John Wayne was a fighter. Brilliant. It's when the Archbishop comes down to see him and they're driving out in the car and Ward Bond covers up his Catholic priest collar and says, "Right, boys, cheer like Protestants." It's a great scene. But anyway, that's Arthur Shields. But Arthur Shields he was a Protestant himself, but actually he was a nationalist as well. And he was involved with the Irish Volunteers. He was an Abbey actor at the time. He ended up under the command of James Connolly in the GPO during 1916, doing his bit in the GPO. Now, the guy who Pierce surrendered to after Easter week was a guy called General Lowe. And his son, his name was John Lowe. And he is in the famous photograph where Pierce is handing his surrender to General Lowe. John Lowe is standing right beside him. He's wearing kind of white pants. You can see him in the picture. So he accepted the surrender and then oversaw a lot of the internment of the rebels in Frongoch, one of which was Arthur Shields. After that rising, Shields denounced all violence and went back to being an actor on the Abbey stage. I never really talked about it. John Lowe was also horrified by what happens during Easter week. He decided to leave the army, also became an actor, changed his name to John Loder, went to Hollywood, became a character actor over there, married Hedy Lamarr, and had quite the career for himself. 25 years after the rising, in 1941, John Ford cast both men in How Green Was My Valley. So in this movie, you have Arthur Shields acting opposite John Loder, 25 years almost to the day that they were taking pot shots at each other across O'Connell Street, which is a fascinating turn of history and the way things turned out for the two of them. And what's interesting, I actually interviewed Arthur Shields' daughter, Christine, about this. And John Loder knew, and he'd overseen Shields' internment in Frongoch. He knew who he was, but Shields never knew this was the guy he'd been trying to shoot, basically, through the windows of the GPO. He never knew it.
Remarkable. And back to Charlie Chaplin, Brian. What was the significance of The Tramp?
So The Tramp, the film came out in 1915, in April, actually, 1915. 100 years ago this month, the film was released. And The Tramp was a short film. It was the first, I suppose, the first time he gave the character a name. He had played the character in shorter two-reel comedies before the movie came out in 1915. So the character had existed when Chaplin first went to the States and worked in the Keystone Studios for Max Sennett. But this was the first time the kind of fully formed character appeared on screen, with the bowler hat, the moustache, the baggy trousers, the cane, the silly walk. And the film The Tramp is a really simple story. He falls in love with a farmer's daughter. He ends up working on a farm. These hobos come and try and rob the farm. Charlie Chaplin's The Tramp, fights them off, and then finds out the girl is already engaged to somebody else. So he loses her in love and he walks off at the end. It's only about 15 or 20 minutes. But it was the first fully formed appearance of The Tramp. And it was a really significant character, and a character that Chaplin went on to portray in movies right up until modern times. When he was resisting the arrival of sound, he still had the mute Tramp character who never spoke, obviously, because it was always silent films. And it became one of the most iconic characters in film history. But 1915, 100 years ago this month, was the time that he first appeared kind of fully formed on the screen.
Great stuff. Well, Brian Redden, filmmaker and film buff, thank you for joining us.
You're very, very welcome.
And we're going straight over to O'Connell Street. Colm Flynn is there. The crowd's gathering, no doubt, Colm.
John Murray, welcome back to O'Connell Street. Yay! People from all over the world were standing just outside the GPO here, and the sun is beating down on us. But, John, what looks really special right now is there are people standing in front of me who are dressed up in clothes that would have been common in 1915. But they're particularly dressed up, John, so I'm not sure what's happening. I see a lady here who's got a beautiful dress on. What's happening?
It's my daughter's wedding today.
Your daughter is getting married today.
And I'm mother of the bride.
Okay,
and
introduce me to the bride.
My daughter is Laura. She looks beautiful.
And John, you can take my word for it. And we tweeted a photograph from the John Murray Show account. Brides look the part. They still do today, but especially in 1915. Describe to me what you're wearing.
So I'm wearing what my mother actually wore to her wedding, but we put a few more frills on it to make it a little bit more modern, I suppose. And it's long. I have a nice long train with nice lace on it and a nice... I'm wearing a corset, so okay. I'm quite nervous because of the wedding, but also I can't breathe.
And she looks good, doesn't she? Yay! Now, John, of course, it is 1915. They didn't meet on Tinder. How did you meet your husband-to-be?
He's from my local parish. He moved there a few years ago, so I hadn't known him my whole life. But yes, I met him at Mass.
Okay, you didn't meet him down the road in Starbucks, no?
Starbucks, what?
Sorry, yes, of course, 1915. And gentlemen, you've got a beautiful jacket on, a waistcoat and a top hat as well. What are you doing here today?
Well, I'm Laura's cousin today and I'm actually thrilled that she's getting married and I never thought I'd see the day. I'm so proud for her. And her in her lovely dress, and it's such a lovely day, so I couldn't wish her the best of luck for the future.
Okay, very good. And more over here, another bride. John, there's lots of people getting married here. Tell me your situation. How did you meet your husband-to-be?
Oh, I think it was a match organised already, so yeah, really excited.
Have you met the guy before?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, you have. Steve very good. John, this is only one of the things that you can see here throughout the day on O'Connell Street. Like we said earlier, it has been pedestrianised, so you can walk freely up and down the street as the sun shines on you. Just down towards the Savoy, there is a beautiful, it's a carousel, a Victorian carousel from the time. That will be spinning in a while. And then, as you heard towards the top of the programme, the tram is right behind us. You can get onto the double-decker tram as well. And there are people from all over the world. Where are you from?
I'm from Terranure.
All over the world and Terran Yur, John.
Sorry about
they've
that.
They've come from that far. And what made you come in today?
Just such a beautiful day. I had heard about it on radio, various advertisements. Just anxious to see, get the atmosphere.
Okay. So Terran Yur, anyone from outside of the country here in front of us, put up your hand. They're all Dubs here at the moment, but I know the crowds are going to be coming in later on. Where are you from?
Dublin.
Are you from Dublin as well? And what made you come in today?
Oh, just to soak up the atmosphere and relive the 1916.
What do you think so far of what you've seen?
It's fantastic, yeah. Long may it continue. Do this every year.
Okay. And what about yourself? Whereabouts are you from?
All the way from Maynooth, County Kildare.
You've travelled far today.
I've travelled far, yeah.
And I see you're dressed in your beautiful clothes from 1915
exactly.
as well.
I am. Dressed up, Callum, for the day with my daughter, Anya.
Anya's there as well. So, John, it all kicks off in around, well, less than 10 minutes. It kicks off at 11 officially. The events are going to be happening throughout the day. Reenactments, talks. There's an arena special that's going to be broadcast from the Gresham Hotel, a full orchestra, and lots more to be enjoyed as well. And I think there's one lady here who's dying to say something on the radio. What is your name?
Nuala Talbot, not really.
Oh, hey, you're coming up to me there like you wanted to say something. Were you just admiring these things?
I was just admiring these ladies and the Edwardian wedding, yes.
It looks lovely, doesn't it?
Very glamorous.
So, John, that is it from all of us here on O'Connell Street, outside the GPO, with the beautiful sunshine down on top of us. It's goodbye for just now from Road to the Rising.
Yay! Oh, thanks indeed. That's Colin Flynn preparing the way for today's events at O'Connell Street. And we're going to finish now with more ukulele playing, but there's been a texter in touch with us, Eileen, wants to know where the actual workshops are being held. Just a quick reminder.
The Dublin Arts Club, and the tickets can be purchased online at www.steeplesessions.com.
Great. And another person looking for the title of Henrietta McGarvey's novel. It's called What Becomes of Us. Well, you're going to play us out now. Before you do, can I thank on sound Damien Chanel. Our broadcast coordinator was Denise Davies and our producer was the series producer, Anna Leddy. But here are the ukulele band now to play us out. We'll be back at 9 in the morning. Till then, slán.
Dancers may be on the